This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I've been interested for many years of the question of how we represent violence. And one of the things that I started, this started more than 20 years ago when I photographed the first Chechen War. In my 20s, I was a documentary photographer and photojournalist based in Russia, and ended up photographing Grozny in 1996. And I got very interested in questions of how we represent conflict, and ended up doing an awful lot of it over a 20-year period. And something that I noticed the more I got involved in that space and the more I worked in it was that the news media, especially the mass media, always sought to find, to use images that were familiar to their viewers. And so they would seek images that responded to specific tropes, specific context, specific definitions that had, they had already predefined as part of their editorial policy. And if you made images or you suggested stories or narratives that didn't fit within those preconceived ideas from the editorial desk, they tended not to make it into the media. And that might seem like it's just an artifact of a particular working culture, but the more I looked at it, the more I realized that this is actually something that's been, that has a much longer history and a much longer trend line in the context of how we make and use images in the representation of military conflict. And so starting around 7 or 8 years ago, I started to get a little bit more serious about this question, and I started looking at historical images of conflict. And the first war was photographed is the Crimean War in 1845 by a guy named Roger Fenton. And at the time, all of the images that were made of conflict were shot through by an individual with a tripod and took a minute and a half, 3 minutes to make an exposure. So almost all of those images are static, right? There's men sitting on horses. There's like, there's all of these kind of images that are very familiar to us from that time period of landscapes and other types of objects. But starting in the 1920s, and really the Spanish Civil War, with the advent of small and mobile cameras, we start to see a different trend line around the representation of violence, which is basically kinetic activities of humans in motion, in which are soldiers and mostly soldiers fighting, holding guns, acting, having agency, seeming to have agency in their role. By coincidence, right around the same time, we saw, basically from World War I onward, we saw the end of agency, of human agency in military conflict as war became massively industrialized and individuals became basically just fodder for cannons. And so we've had this kind of diverging trend line between the idea that that we represent war with soldiers as heroes in telling stories through their perspective and a narrative frame in which activities of soldiers are important to the conduct or the outcome of war. And while that is true, it is also equally, if not more true, that the military, that militaries are constructed of economics, of constructed of supply lines, constructed of advanced technology, holding and keeping space, and the role of the individual as an active fighter, somebody who is able to kill with a handgun or a weapon, is those individuals are just frankly interchangeable, in a way that is both familiar to us and very tragic. And yet, the way we represent conflicts has basically not changed in the last 100 years. There are a small number of representative tropes for how we photograph and represent soldiers and others fighting war. And it's quite remarkable, actually, that there's about 30 of them. And you can kind of look at every series that you would find in mass media of how we see war, and you'll say, oh yeah, that image looks like thousands of others that I've seen before. Which is one reason why I think, and this is not probably a very original thought, but why I think that we have become so inured to those kinds of images. Because they're basically carbon copies of one another. And as you know very well, once you see enough of something, you stop seeing it. You start to become immune to its emotional effects or impacts in some ways. And there's been another history of photographic the use of images in conflict, which is about the representation of landscape, and it's a lot more conceptual. We're not going to talk about that too much tonight, but I just wanted to recognize, and some of the Hiroshima work on the back wall looks at that a little bit. So I became a fellow at the Library of Congress about 2 years ago, and my research project there was to look at old documentary propaganda films from Vietnam, and I started with collections from Vietnam, Germany, Italy, and Japan from World War II, and also looked at a lot of still images from World War I, and all the way back to the Fenton images, which are all actually at the library, so I was able to look at some of those originals, which is really great fun. And I started to try to identify these visual tropes and to capture and create kind of repetitive objects and almost like shards of these archives of thousands of films, and found that regardless of the ideology of the maker, whether it was a German or an American or a Vietnamese, once again, we're seeing exactly the same kind of image construction. And sometimes in those years, especially in the 1930s, you would even see the same newsreel teams photographing or filming for different people on different sides of an ideological conflict. And so it's interesting to me that we continue to kind of create mystification of conflict through the use of images, and yet when we look over the expanse of history, we find that we actually haven't got very far. And I think I'll stop there for the moment and let Sam jump in with a little bit about what he's talking about, and we'll have a conversation.
Great. Thanks for the invitation to be here, Ivan and the gallery. So maybe I'll contextualize in the work that over the past 25 years Witness has focused on. So Witness is a human rights network. We were founded after a very iconic incident of a citizen filming human rights violations, the Rodney King incident that took place in LA, and an ordinary person documented over 50 blows struck on Rodney King after a traffic stop. And in some ways, our vision was ahead of its time in that it was this idea that as more and more people had cameras, what would this result in? And so over the past 25 years, we've grappled with this kind of, I guess it's a contradiction, and it's some of what Ivan is touching on, is that clearly seeing is not necessarily believing, right? And that no piece of video, whether shot by a citizen or a journalist or a police officer, is trustworthy in and of itself. And we want to contest these videos that are created. On the other hand, we also want to reflect their intense potential value, particularly since the sort of digital revolution, to reflect a vast array of human rights realities that weren't seen before. And so over the past 25 years, what Witness has done is work with progressively larger concentric circles of the people who have access to image-making technology. So if you think 25 years ago, actually George Holliday, who filmed the Rodney King incident, it was kind of unusual that happened. It was dramatic. George Holliday, who had a really interesting history, actually he had lived under the Argentine dictatorship, so he actually was someone who had a sensitivity to human rights issues, but he hadn't bought the camera to film human rights violations. He just looked out his window and he saw what was happening. And for many years, we worked primarily with nonprofits and NGOs around the world, working on a range of issues from land rights to elder rights to war crimes. And then over the past 15 years, you've seen the sort of explosion of mobile video, of grassroots documentation, and a kind of related growth of people sharing false accounts as well. You know, the trajectory, and we've been part of a lot of the growth of a movement you might describe as kind of the movement of sort of video as evidence, which is this idea also reflected in some of the work of groups like Bellingcat that, you know, you can both proactively help individuals document their reality in ways that stand up better, and you can also analyze the reality that's shot by perpetrators, shot by ordinary civilians, and turn it into kind of evidence. And one sort of thought that strikes me as I listen to you, Ivan, is that so much of that is actually training people to fit into kind of preconceived patterns, right? Like the nature of video as evidence is actually, you're actually trying to train people to fit the expectations of a judicial system, which is very different from the expectations of what you might show to your community or to mobilize public opinion. So it's a really interesting dynamic of kind of this, how much do we try and get people, as more and more people document video, to sort of fit in the boxes of institutional power, and how much do we try and get them to challenge it, and what is the balance within that? In the last 18 months, as Aaron was mentioning, I've been almost exclusively focused on deepfakes. And I think these are really, I don't know how many people are familiar with deepfakes, but essentially it's a new generation of ways in which you can manipulate video and audio to make it look like someone did something or said something that they never did. Now, that was possible in Hollywood. It has been possible for 20 years. And right, I think both Ivan and I, a lot of the time we place things in historical context. Nothing is ever new. What is new about deepfakes is the accessibility, the ability to do it more seamlessly, the ability to place it into an environment of distrust that makes people more likely to want to believe it or to believe it. And so I've spent the past 18 months trying to look at this question of, as it becomes easier and easier for people to fake audio and video, or to claim that something is fake, right? Because it's just as easy to say it's a deepfake as to actually believe it's a deepfake, right? So you get this kind of recursive loop of people saying, it's a fake. No, it's not a fake. Prove it's not a fake. I can't prove it's not a fake. Well, therefore, it's a fake, right? How do we defend the fact that there is still real value in this explosion of citizen documentation while reconciling ourselves to the real challenges we're facing, right? So I think that's where I come from, and this is like, you know, where do we recognize what's happening around us around image culture and distrust, but not get completely carried away with pessimism. And I say that also as we're sitting here in Philly, we're sitting here in the US, we're all pretty privileged. I'm gonna just make a guess, given that we're here, we're sitting listening to a gallery talk. A lot of the distrust at the moment, including what people are pushing back on social media platforms, is driven by a sense that nothing is going right. While when I look globally, I see plenty of places where there was never any mainstream media, where there was never any kind of institutionalized truth checking apparatus. How do we defend the fact that some of this infrastructure, incredibly flawed infrastructure of sharing information, like something like Facebook, incredibly flawed, has also facilitated tremendous benefits in some ways? So, and I think that's important to name when we're in the US, because so much of the decisions are driven about 150 miles from here in DC, mm-hmm. or 3,000 miles from here in Silicon Valley, and have very little to do with the rest of the world. So I think as we have this conversation, we also need to think who's missing in this discussion and what do they want out of these sort of image making apparatus and sort of distribution systems.
Yeah, that's it, right. I mean, one of the things that's been fascinating to me about in the last 25 years is we've moved pretty decisively away from, and Witness was very early at this, as you say, away from the common idea of image, photographic image as representation, to acknowledging that images are images as evidence, image as a sensing technology, image as witness, in which the camera itself is now recording, and all of the metadata, all of the kind of contextualization that we used to do about images is now intrinsic to the image itself. And image ultimately as control, because especially as we've started to see the mass spread of CCTV and gained knowledge and awareness of how we change our behavior when we know that we're being observed in social spaces and in a mass context. So the ubiquity of image recording devices is also changing the way we are in the world. And fascinatingly, it's also worth knowing that thinking about how cameras and the apparatus that we use to make images have their own intentionality. They see the world in their own way, even without us holding it and making an image. And so we have these kind of traditional narrative techniques that we use for making images that we've all learned to read. Those of us who have been educated in the film world, or if you've grown up watching TV, you innately learn how to see an image. That is not something you will get if you've not grown up in an image culture. But now we are experiencing cameras as a functional element in how we organize society as well. And some of that was latent in the analog era of image making and is now explicit.
It's interesting because I think that there's a much more nuanced, broader understanding of different sort of almost cultures of image making. So with the activists we work with, you see a lot of kind of very nuanced understanding about decisions to share images because of the implications for safety, right? Mm-hmm. Decisions around live streaming, right? How do you make that decision in a way that is informed? Decisions about distribution, like we've sort of, you know, I'm going to not use the word democratize because that's a terrible phrase for this, but you see a much greater sort of media literacy on the nuances of different ways of using image making. So I think about kind of image making around police violence. There's something interesting that happens there where we saw, and in fact, you know, we've actively trained with groups doing this, kind of people making decisions about holding back images, mm-hmm. right? When is the right moment to release a video of police violence? You want to use it as a counterpoint to the police account, not as the precursor to the police account, right? Because you actually don't have first mover advantage. If you release it first, you get explained away, right? You get the police say, no, you didn't see what happened before, you don't see that. If you do it the other way around, the police account comes out first, and then you are able to reveal the failings in that account. And so it sort of speaks to this kind of sort of contest of images and the framing of images that's happening. But like this idea of kind of nuance and skills is really interesting to look at when you step beyond. It's just this sort of idea of people just taking photos or videos.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also, there's also the whole question of chain of custody of mm-hmm. imagery here. Because, so I don't know if any of you had the chance to look at this film in the back room. If you haven't yet, I'll tell you very briefly about what it is. It's a compilation of two different pieces of newsreel footage made by a German newsreel company in 1934. The images come from a moment in which the U.S. National Guard, New York National Guard, has faked a communist demonstration and then suppressed it with tear gas for the German newsreel company to film to then broadcast back in Germany. So it's the American military collaborating with the Germans to make an anti-communist newsreel clip, piece of propaganda. In August of 1934, and then the voiceover comes from a May 1934 gathering of 25,000 ethnic Germans in Madison Square Garden to protest the embargo of U.S. embargo of German goods. So we have this massive. These are two pieces of evidence that were that basically are the U.S. supporting in different ways the German cause in 1934, after Hitler has taken power. Both of these pieces in the German newsreel footage are presented in ways that don't give you quite enough information to actually say, this absolutely happened the way the newsreel claimed that it happened. There is a break in what we call in forensic language and evidentiary language, a chain of custody. Right, the film has been made. The Germans claim that it was made in collaboration with the U.S. military. It's probably true, but really hard to absolutely prove it. But that's just an example of noting how this issue is always present in the creation and construction of images. But today, in the context of what Sam is talking about, when you can't trust the image as an artifact in itself, then demonstrating the chain of custody from its creation to its distribution to its release, demonstrating that if it's been changed or manipulated in any way, that you have a record of that so that it can actually be used as a piece of evidence, or if you're using it even for journalistic work, that you can say this definitely documents the thing that we claim it documents, has become an increasingly elaborate exercise. In part because it has become, in the digital context, so easy to simply fabricate material that is seamlessly undifferentiated from the actual documentation of things that actually happen in the world. And the forensic work that Bellingcat is a great example of how one seeks to recreate the steps, the effort that you go through to recreate that kind of evidentiary chain.
Yeah, I love this archival project. Partly, it reminds me of my family was trying to flee Germany around then, so it's an interesting bit of history I had no idea about that. Meanwhile, Germans here were busy protesting. Mm. also because it's so interesting, and I'm curious to hear you talk more about archives, because it's so I've worked in this space for like 25 years, and we honestly didn't talk much about archives in a meaningful way 25 years. We thought about them as libraries, as places that had preserved our footage, and Witness has an incredible archive of, you know, of older human rights footage. Mm. But I don't think most human rights activists centrally thought about archives. I think they thought of it as something very separate. And I think this was a question of volume, right? There wasn't that much volume, so it wasn't like you had a terrible problem trying to track your footage. If you were a human rights activist, there was a tape deck, you know, set of tapes on your wall, and you could pull out the one you remembered. Mm-hmm. And it's really a sea change I've seen in the last few years, is like the thing we get requested almost most to train on is archiving, like managing your media, tracking authenticity, tracking what you have even. And I think that's a really interesting sort of shifting. Mm. And then at the same time, we see something interesting happening now. So when we've done threat modeling around deepfakes, a place that people point to is they're like, these archives are just the perfect thing to mess with, right? Because there's plentiful footage of public figures who don't have a right to challenge it. There's all this content that can be faked and forged and changed unless you've tracked it well. So I just been thinking a lot about archives, and I'm curious, like, where do you see... How do you think about archives in the digital space? So a lot of this is pulled out of analog, at least your own work. Where does this go, and how do we sort of protect that archival value moving forward?
Well, I was really interested in the moment of transition from analog to digital archive, because the natural state of an analog archive is actually slow disintegration, mm-hmm. right? I mean, most of the stuff...
Or I know of a digital archive.
And in a digital archive in different ways.
Even faster than a digital
archive. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's fast disintegration in a digital archive. And in a material one, it's slow. But a lot of times what an archivist will do is there won't be a cataloging of objects, but at point by point, the level of the object. There'll be a cataloging of objects at the level of category. And so with the film archives that I worked in, a lot of this stuff has never been seen before. I mean, it was collected... very loosely cataloged. There's no description or very bad description of what's actually in the material. So you actually have to watch it in order to know what's there. Mm-hmm. And there'll be boxes and boxes and boxes. And there's a lot of stuff that they won't let you see. If there's a master copy, they won't let you watch it because it's a negative. And if it gets destroyed, then there's no positive. But if there's only a negative, then it exists only as a negative, and you're not allowed to actually watch it. So part of my exercise was to see what they would let me do with material that was, how much they would let me repurpose it into the digital space. And that was kind of a provocation, like, would they let me, something had a copyright on it, would they let me bring a camera near it and refilm it or not? Or did I have to obscure it in some way? There are a lot of, an archive is a set of rules for managing, and it's also underlying it a narrative. It's a set of narrative claims about what fits within a collection and what is excluded from it. It's much, much easier to do that in the digital space, to spin up an archive or spin up a collection, but those are also, I think, probably not intended for posterity necessarily, mm-hmm. in the way that a classic traditional, because if you actually have to go to the trouble of building a physical archive, you really need significant resources to maintain it, and you're expecting it to be around for a long time. But a digital archive has also a different temporality to it. The Library of Congress, curiously, has, starting in around 2010, built a set of collections, online collections, around events. And they gathered some of our work, and which is how I became aware of it. My work as mine, meaning Global Voices, we did a bunch of coverage around, especially around the Arab uprisings, and they were tracking collections around that material. So, for example, they did a big collection around the end of the Sri Lankan Civil War. They scraped everything they could find on that topic, and that was digital, and then they encapsulated it, and they built a bunch of metadata around it, and then it just kind of sat there. There's another, probably a better example that comes from the Yale humanitarian folks who took the WPA program, the U.S. 1930s footage of 1930s poverty, basically. Sorry, I'm forgetting the word. And there's a massive collection of US funded image making here. And they built a really interesting, the Yale Humanities Program built a really interesting digital organizational structure for it. It's called Photogrammar, I think. And it's got a very extensive and very granular metadata architecture. And they also had to, in the process, digitize all of it. So it, in a way, whether or not it's originally digital or not, with an archive space, what really becomes important is the narrative you set for it and the limits which you exclude from it, because otherwise it could just be absolutely everything.
Yeah. It's, I'm thinking, and it's about kind of...
Depression, that was the word I was looking for.
That's the word. Archives and curation. There was a project we worked on with groups working with trans and gender non-conforming people around violence against those groups in the US. And what was really interesting there, and I think about a lot on kind of sort of how we frame images, that was a curation project, which is why I'm thinking about in this space, where we were facing a challenge, which is a common problem identified by trans and gender non-conforming people was trying to assert the level of violence they faced, particularly trans people of color, trans women of color, against a rhetoric that was a rhetoric around, this was a couple of years ago, around the bathroom bill kind of discussion, right, that that this is a discussion around trans people's rights about access to bathrooms, right, which is clearly a part of protection, it's clearly a part of rights issues, but it was being used to kind of sort of make this a discussion that seemed very minimal. Seemed, you know, like this is petty, right? A lot of the framing around this was bathroom bills to a certain set of the population was like, that's petty, that's not a major discussion. And these groups were saying, how do we show the level of violence, given that the federal government was not gathering statistics, in order to prove to people? And so what we did was work with, to look at, for all the videos online that show transphobic violence, that show assaults on trans people or gender non-conforming people that are shared online to celebrate them. And so I'm hoping most of you have not spent much time looking for transphobic hate videos online. There are a lot of them. They are shared. They're often filmed by someone who celebrates filming them. You know, they may shout out something like going viral. They may shout out the name of a website where they know they're going to upload it to. Mm-hmm. And so these are unashamedly not shot for the right purposes. These are shot to celebrate violence. They're shot to celebrate an assault on someone. And they vastly outnumber the number of witnesses who film these in a sort of evidentiary way. And this is probably true in a number of other scenarios. If we look at war crimes, there's a distressing number of the videos of war crimes are shot by the perpetrators.
Absolutely.
Right? So this is not unusual. Yeah. What it does tell you is, though, there is this sort of hidden archive that gives you this data point, this way of saying it. Now, none of these videos were shot with this purpose. None of them were filmed as evidence. They were filmed to celebrate violence. But when you do this scraping, you see a massive number of these videos and a massive number of likes and approving comments. So you have sort of parallel data sets of people choosing to celebrate this, the volume of views, hundreds of millions of views, and the volume of likes. And so as you start to think about any of one of these individual videos would be something we would not want to share. The volume, and in this project, we didn't share the videos. We were using literally as data. But the reason I think it's interesting is it's sort of taking this idea of an archive and of curation, and it's trying to think, how do we do that when all these data points weren't created with this intention? You're sort of literally completely flipping the valence of the intention of the filmer, the intention to celebrate, the desire to have it watched, and you're saying, no, no, and no, right? We're not going to celebrate it. We're not going to let people watch it. And we're going to use it against the purpose you did it in. So I think it's something really interesting as we sort of talk about the complexity of images, to think about this sort of flipping of the filmer's intention that is happening almost as much as the kind of the sort of nuanced understanding maybe of why people are filming and sort of conscious sort of positioning.
Yeah, that's a really interesting there's a really interesting idea around norms and positioning there, because I mean, one of the challenges that we traditionally have in our space is around the areas of absence or areas of ignorance. And so when we look like from a perspective of historiography, we talk about the things we know about, we don't talk about the things we don't know about. And so a big part of the work of our kind of work about looking around ideas around underrepresentation or looking around areas of lack of documentation is trying to fill out figure out where else we should be looking to create more space to see, to change it, to construct narratives that help us to see ideas that are occurring. So there's a filling out of ignorance that's a kind of a really active way of kind of a certain kind of activism, I would say, in terms of image culture. And what you're talking about is actually almost the opposite. It's like a strategic silence of flagging and identifying material that you think of as terroristic. I mean, I'm not a big fan of the countering violent extremism world for lots of reasons, but in other contexts of this kind of absolutely hateful and illegal, often illegal expression in many countries, it's almost there is a normative intent behind the identification of the archive as well, which is to obscure it in some ways. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's to obscure it, though actually you raising the counter-violent extremists, so it's interesting, like YouTube, which is where many of these videos were found, does an overly good job, in inverted commas, of removing violent extremism content and war crimes footage.
Which means you can't then use it as evidence.
You can't use it as evidence.
Because you can't find it.
But they hadn't done a very good job of removing this violence. So how they define what is violence that is not acceptable, that is political violence, that is hate violence, is very much determined by where the political pressure is.
Right.
Because so all these videos are up on YouTube. They have tons of views. They're not invisible. These are not hiding in a corner of the internet. Mm-hmm. They have, in some cases, millions of views. While a war crimes video that might be perceived as terrorist content gets zapped by the algorithm pretty quickly off
Absolutely,
YouTube.
It does.
So
yeah.
So there is a political statement around algorithms here and power, and that's so YouTube is allowing the visibility at the same time as we're trying to say we don't want to make this visible, we want to use it as data.
I mean, in a very succinct way, what it tells us is that the dominant political narratives about what is perceived to be a threat, in this case terrorism, is the thing that gets the attention, the money, the algorithmic suppression, and ideas that are not perceived to be a threat are allowed to flourish. And in this case, the last 15 years is very clear that where all of that energy has gone and where it has not. So it's an indication or a signal for what we care about in our cultures. We've been talking a while, so maybe we should open up the floor. Yeah.
Sam, you were talking about the lack of YouTube does a good job of censoring a lot of these videos, taking them offline, but not for the violence against non-conforming trans and other communities. Is that a representation of the dynamic you were talking about before, about there's norms about how we define what violence is, and in this case, they've defined that violence is terrorist violence, but not violence against oppressed communities?
That's correct. So the violence they're looking for, and that they're willing to spend energy and resource and treasure on suppressing, is based on the political pressure that they're getting to respond to those particular types of image making, right? So they're not taking down hate speech or targeted threats against women in Pakistan, for example, of which there's also a huge amount. They're not taking down this kind of threat, but they are taking down terror threats that are linked to a certain kind of geopolitical position, a certain kind of communities in the world who have taken positions opposing state power.
Yeah, and even, of course, on violent extremism, they're probably taking down less right-wing Hindu nationalist content versus...
And less American nationalist
American
content.
American far-right content, if we took two major powers in the world versus far-right or extremist Islamic content. I think the other thing, and this is a changing dynamic over the past 3 or 4 years, is increasing use of AI algorithms and the decision what data gets put into them in order to help them make decisions. So the training data that informs the algorithms, like in many AI algorithms, has bias in it that sets it up for some things. They're not setting it on the transphobic violence, but as they put it on something like extremist content, what are they picking up? It's the data points they fed in.
Mm-hmm. So Sam, can you explain really briefly at what point human interpretation comes into an analysis of those data sets for YouTube?
Yeah, so...
This is fascinating.
So when you think about content moderation, which is content moderation is how you make a decision about what stays up and down on YouTube, the vast majority of violent extremist content is taken down automatically. And so it comes out of an algorithm that has training data from previous examples of that, which probably are previous examples of perceived violent Islamic extremism. There is almost no transparency on the data sets. And in the last couple of years, there's been a significant struggle in the human rights community involving many groups, particularly a group called the Syrian Archive, based out of Europe, because one summer day in August 2017, hundreds of thousands of videos of Syrian war crimes disappeared from the internet. They disappeared from YouTube because YouTube had altered their algorithm. And the algorithm now saw all these videos that had been shared as evidence of war crimes. They're often violent, but they're clearly labeled, you know, this is evidence of a bombing, or this is, you know, I'm sharing this to demonstrate it's war crime. They literally just blipped off the internet overnight. And so it's sort of a reminder of the power in these algorithms and the power of the choices that are made in the data you put into them. This wasn't a human choice at the point of each individual content item. It was a choice right at the sort of the building and maintenance of the data set that fed into that algorithm.
So this goes back to the beginning of a conversation, because for a computer, for an algorithm to be able to see certain types of images, those images have to be representative of a type. In other words, they have to be a trope. They have to be the thing that I started looking at, the thing that piqued my curiosity many years ago around this which led to this project, which is that we see these types of images in a certain way, and also we conduct ourselves in accordance with the expectations of those images. So if we think about terror acts in the 20th century versus the 21st century, terror acts are, in the 20th century, were created for mass media audiences. They're epic in scale, they're sensational in form, they're meant to frighten, they're meant to be rebroadcast through a mass construct. 21st century terror acts, so like the apex of that, of course, is 9/11. 21st century terror acts are made to be read on your screen. They're individualized, just like every other kind of media. And so the apex of the 21st century terror act is the beheading of a single journalist in Syria by ISIS. One person, one death, witnessed by you alone. It's a major shift in terms of how terror is conducted and also how we witness it. But I would like to say that both of those kinds of acts are representative are still maintain the expectations of narrative of how we're going to see them, right? And then Hollywood will pick them up and reprogram them for its own storytelling purposes, which then retrains the next generation of people who are fighting in wars to imagine themselves in playing that same role. I mean, I remember like the first time I photographed a war, the Chechens, they all dressed, the Chechen paramilitaries all dressed like Rambo. They took their cues for masculinity from Hollywood. They understood how to act as soldiers from watching films, except they all wore these little high-heeled boots that made them look like satyrs. So there's this kind of curious circularity that's between representation and then the execution of action in the world that then feeds back into the next generation of representation. Yeah, go ahead. We have a mic, please.
Feels like the summer's events in Hong Kong and the kind of drama playing out in the global stage there must be kind of ripe for your observations and notes and future projects. Like a couple visuals that come to mind were the toppling of the surveillance pole. Like, I mean, that was just extraordinary. I think the extent to which the I don't even know if it's right to call them protesters, that just
people.
The extent to which right the people are you know, wearing face masks and other efforts to kind of play off or protect themselves from the surveillance society. And I think what's most terrifying about this is that we haven't yet seen the repercussions of that. I'm really just throwing it out there more as like some subject matter for you guys to comment on some thoughts, maybe some ways to help us think through some of what this last 6 months has brought.
Sure. I've been very fortunate that I have with Global Voices, we have an amazing writer and editor from Hong Kong her name is Oi Wan Lam, and she runs her own human rights media activism project there, and she's been our writer and editor for East Asia for 12 years at least. And Oi Wan is an amazing person to read on this topic. She's probably written 30 stories in the last 6 months on this topic. And so I'm, everything I know about it comes from her. I just want to acknowledge that first. There's the extent to which the protesters in Hong Kong have chosen this kind of a sense of like very fluid tactics around their work is really remarkable. They're so aware of this observance function, and they have a motto of being like water in terms of constantly changing their tactics and trying to confront or confuse the surveillance approach. And that's everything from the routes that they've chosen to walk to the ideas around simultaneous pop-up demonstrations around the city. So rather than having a parade, they are instead just appearing en masse on the streets and then vanishing again back into normal everyday pedestrian traffic. All of that is a way of attempting to frustrate the traditional mechanisms of public control. And it's a contest, because as soon as they try one technique, then the authorities come up with a way of suppressing it, and then they have to try something else. So with that technique, the state spun up these groups of thugs who were out in the suburbs beating people in the subways, to kind of basically as a symbol to say, you know, don't try a pop-up demonstration here, folks. We know you're doing it. So it's a very fascinating contest. Sam, I'm sure you listened to that.
Yeah, a few observations, and Witness doesn't work so closely in Hong Kong, so I don't have some of those insights. I think one of the things that we've seen as a constant tension for activists using video over the past decade that gets ever more acute is the tension between visibility and anonymity. And how you manage that when the expectations are that you sort of stick with one or the other, when in fact the reality is, you know, one day you desperately want people to be paying attention to you, the other day you want to be anonymous as you share content. And our platforms, the way we're tracked on mobile devices, does not facilitate that, nor do, and we were talking about this a bit earlier, sort of the movement towards demanding that people in this kind of sort of sensor journalism type sort of mode share more metadata, share more proof that it's them creating content. That's a very double-edged sword, right? Like sharing more data to prove who you are is sharing more data to track you down. The other thing we see, and we've been paying a lot of attention to, and you see it in Hong Kong, and you see it worse in many other locations, but it's a global trend, is kind of a pushback on what you might call the right to record, which is generally a recognition by governments that there is something quite powerful in citizens filming back and either legally or extra-legally attacking that. And it is a globalized trend. It's less legally happening in the US because of jurisprudence, but it happens extra-legally all the time, right? The people who try and film the police face trumped-up charges or assault. And we're seeing that happening more and more globally, and that's sort of the flip side of it. The other problem, I think you were sort of referencing it in the kind of we don't know where this goes, is, you know, most modes of protecting anonymity in a group setting in a crowded urban environment where you have multiple surveillance sources and you're carrying mobile devices are not effective, right? So the ability to track people in that space, I would not be optimistic on people's ability to evade that. And I don't think people are not conscious of this. So this is not a critique of activists. It's simply a recognition that it's extremely hard in that environment to protect your anonymity.
Yeah, I mean, one of the approaches that people are taking in Hong Kong is basically to say, we know that they're watching us, and the only recourse we have is that there are so many of us that they won't be able to suppress us all. Yeah. And which is basically the only thing you have left at a certain point as a tactic. And I've seen that in other places. So I used to live in Russia, and I've spent a lot of time in 2012 I was there during and just after a wave of protests in Russia. And the Russian protesters and activists have the assumption that everything that they do is going, that they will not be able to maintain anonymity, that they won't be able to attain organizational integrity, that there's people within their networks who are going to betray their trust. They're spies, they're moles. The Russians are also very good at physical surveillance. The Russians are good at, you know, at long distance oral surveillance. And so if you think you can actually beat that kind of like focused state surveillance, pretty much in any state, you're wrong. any sophisticated modern state, you're wrong. But the Russians have always been especially good at it. So as an organizational tactic, everybody who ran those events basically said, if you want to be part of the org comitate, you have to agree to let your life, your entire life, be basically transparent. Be transparent. You've got to expect that you've got no privacy. So everything from our planning to everything else, we should expect that it's going to be seen. Because that's, and then we just have to go ahead and do it, and we put our bodies on the line. And that's the only way you can kind of counter those kinds of positions. And it, as a fascinating counterpoint to that, in the age of so much, such an abundance of information and media, the other challenge that those kinds of activists have is simply being seen, which goes against this whole other idea. So many of the folks that we worked with in the Arab uprisings and for the few years after, we would ask them, are you aware of your physical security, your digital security? Are you paying attention to these issues? And they say, you know what? Our biggest problem is actually being seen. We care much more about that than whether or not we're secure. And so, once again, we have these really, those are not necessarily contradictions, but they sort of sit as two clusters of really contradictory questions that people who are trying to achieve things in public space have to confront.
Yeah. Let me add one note sparked by your observation about transparency. And we've been spent a lot of the last year talking to not the usual suspects around expected threats from deepfakes. So a lot of the discussion around deepfakes is around, you know, is Senator Rubio going to be hit by a deepfake or Donald Trump? And maybe, but they're pretty well protected should that happen. The people who are vulnerable are the people who already, and this is particularly women journalists, women civic activists, the ones who already face targeted non-consensual sexual image attacks, reputation attacks. And the problem with deepfakes is you don't require it to be an actual image. You can fake this and create it. And so they, you know, point to these risks as ones they worry about, because in movement work, you rely on your credibility and your reputation. And you also are extremely vulnerable to those types of attacks because you don't have security around you. You're not a politician. You're not an institutional figure.
Which is why it's so fascinating that, you know, traditionally from a human rights perspective, one claim we make about the distinction between how we treat normal people around things like defamation and libel or hateful expression and politicians and other public figures is public figures don't get a pass. Like, you treat them exactly the same as everybody else, or you even make it harder. Dictators or authoritarian regimes tend to create special classes of law for their leaders. They tend to say, well, it's criminal libel to libel, the president of the country, for example. And so we've had this kind of curious moment in this country where it appears as if the social media companies are creating a special set of rules for politicians and other public figures when it comes to the limits of what is acceptable expression on their platform. So Trump regularly gets a pass in terms of Twitter's terms of service. Others would not get the same passes, and that is that kind of position from Twitter's perspective is basically replicating what Kazakhstan would do for their president in terms of saying, well, Nazarbayev gets a pass, and if you libel him, we'll put you in jail, but if you libel, you know, the guy around the corner, not a problem. Yeah. You know, so there's this kind of interesting, you know, creeping trends within the choices that the companies are making, which they're making for entirely self-interested reasons around popularity and like who keeps people, holds people, creates attention on their platforms.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't disagree with you, but can you articulate how you think it does that? How they get the pass?
Well, if you violate Twitter's terms of service and they are aware of it, they will censor you. They will take. They will give you a timeout. Usually there's like a three strikes. I actually don't remember the most recent version, but after a certain time, they'll just kick you off the platform. So they have rules about like what you can say to, how you can act if people are complaining about your behavior, and if you transgress those rules, they will eventually kick you off the platform. Things like hate speech, incitement to violence, targeted expression against groups. Every company has its own terms around what is and is not acceptable speech, but in general, those are the parameters. So, for example, Facebook defines hate speech, a certain kind of hate speech, as targeting a group and you remember this exactly? Targeting a group and a certain kind of hate, a certain kind of hateful expression.
Yeah, that, so it's not always what you'd think of it logically. I think the case with President Trump on Twitter is that clearly he, in a number of cases, would violate those. And in a heartbeat, a human rights activist who did the same thing, who is reported, would be thrown off. Mm-hmm. I think the other dimension to that, which is what we've got this kind of sort of contestation of now on Facebook, is like, should political ads be fact-checked? Should a fake ad? And then how do you define a politician? You know, the lens I look at those through is also just seeing how they play out globally, right? All of these rules, when you take them out of a U.S. context, and a lot of them are responding to a U.S. context right now, they play out if you put them in Duterte's Philippines, Bolsonaro's Brazil, Orban's Hungary, where you have even less rail guards and much more political pressure on the platforms, right? Go to Hun Sen's Cambodia, pretty clear pressure from... directly from the government on Facebook on terms of decisions they make on the platform. So,
yep, absolutely. So, yep. Any other questions or comments? You think you want to make one, so you should make one. I'm sure it'll be good.
I'm just interested in, given that this has become kind of public space, what kind of organizing is happening in terms of people, you know, contesting those kinds of rules?
There's a huge amount of contestation of those rules. Almost every day you'll see an editorial about it in the mass media. I think in the U.S. there's a certain kind of, I don't quite know what to call it, a moral panic around that I think is somewhat deterministic in terms of their understanding of how the platforms work. Just for example, really quickly, Facebook may not be right to not want to choose whether or not political speech is factual, but actually that is not Facebook's issue. That's a legal precedent that's been around for quite a while, and I can tell you for sure that the media outlets that are complaining about Facebook not doing it are also not doing it. So like ABC, CNN, Fox News, they can also broadcast political advertising that is not true, and in fact they are obliged to do so. If they choose to broadcast political advertising.
Yeah. I think it's one of the good things of the past few years has been there is more and more and better representation in the pressure on the platforms to do it better. So, you know, the most visible thing here in the US is maybe this sort of moral panic and the kind of commentary. But there are an increasing number of organizing happening in the Global South, groups like the Next Billions Coalition, which comes from places like Myanmar and India, mm-hmm. that is saying we need to be directly in dialogue with the companies to make sure concerns from our countries and from the Global South are there. And then also much more actively, minority communities, people of color in the US have said you need to be listening to us. So the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and others have really said, like, Facebook, you need to be listening to us. Now, is that balanced against incumbent power within those platforms? So Facebook, as an example, really pulled in a lot of, you know, conservative and right-wing, center-right policy figures in some ways to compensate for the new administration, who are probably setting much of the policy within Facebook now at that level. So this is definitely, there is a seesawing going on here about where to position this. And as I say, I think a real implications of how US debates transfer globally. And that's why, to my mind, what's most important is not only do we have voices being heard equally in the US around this, particularly voices of people who are being actually harmed, not people who just perceive a harm, but actually globally that we're listening. Otherwise, we'll come up with yet more poor solutions to the problems. And we only need to look at like Myanmar in 2014 to 16, where Facebook is arguably culpable in a genocide, or at least accessory to see what happens when this is not done well, and when the attention and the resources are not paid to elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, or Duterte's election in the Philippines in 2016. There are many examples of that sort. There are other also interesting attempts to try to get the companies to follow international human rights norms and standards, because there is actually a large body of precedent and in international human rights law around how to handle these kinds of issues. The companies are quite resistant to doing that explicitly. They will take They will certainly listen to the people who are speaking from that context. For example, the UN has a freedom of expression rapporteur who's very, very sharp on these issues, named David Kaye, K-A-Y-E. If you follow him on Twitter, you'll get a lot of good thinking. And he also links to a lot of really smart writing on this topic. So following David is a good way to get more involved in this space. But interestingly, when you talk to the company's policy people directly, they will not accept that restriction, even though it would actually solve a lot of problems for them, because then they could say, well, instead of the kind of completely random mishmash of rules and norms and regulations that we've created for ourselves because we had to do something, we can say, well, look, this is a norm, this is an international norm, here's all the precedent, and we're following, it might not be right 10% of the time, but at least we can say there's a standard, and now they can't do that. But once their challenge is a liability issue, so once they actually accept that kind of external standard, they kind of have to stay with it. And so they're really trying not to be forced to accept some kind of norm that might sometime down, it's future-proofing against some either event or some kind of change in their business model that might want to allow them to change their behavior.
Yeah. One interesting, maybe not an exception, but you may have heard of the Facebook Oversight Board, which was
yes,
this.
Yes, very much so.
You've definitely heard of it, I know. which is sort of this idea of having kind of like a Supreme Court for Facebook. It's actually not a Supreme Court because, you know, it's to adjudicate these content moderation decisions, the really tough ones. And there's an interesting reference. They just launched it to using international human rights standards in the board's decisions. But I actually think it may be of the same piece as you're describing, which is it's basically like this other group can make decisions with this, but we're not, you know, and we'll take those decisions at an individual level around case X or case Y, and in some sense they're sort of offshoring the human rights to this other body. But it's an interesting moment because it's something that people have fought for to have much more attention to the standards that have been agreed by, you know, over 150, 170 countries if you look at like certainly civil and political rights. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Hi, you mentioned civil rights groups. Actually, a group of civil rights leaders is meeting with Facebook next week. What should they ask?
Would you like to take that, Sam?
I think there's a sort of a set of things that they should be demanding. I think one of the problems at the moment is there is a false parity of concerns around everything from fake news to hate speech on Facebook. And it goes back to what I was describing of this question of kind of overcompensating towards the right. So the most extreme harms on hate speech, both in the US and globally, affect people who are marginalized and vulnerable in societies, and those are typically minorities in that society of various kinds. So we have to push back on the false parity and say, look, you know, this isn't just a PR decision. This has real human implications for communities. And then there's really, it really depends on the product, but in general, there's a whole set of questions which are like, how transparent are you about how you handle content on this, how you handle something like hate speech? How transparent are you on how you allow people to say this is hate speech, or to challenge if you're accused of hate speech and your speech is taken down and it's not? Right, so transparency is a huge part of what people are saying. And then actually acting on things that are harmful in ways that respect international human rights law or US domestic law. There is a vast range of responsiveness, which again goes back to this thing we were mentioning earlier about who gets dealt with by the terms of service. And in this case, they're not paying attention to hate speech, to aggression towards people who are already facing threats. So it's the false parity, it's transparency, it's genuinely investing resources to implement policies, but making sure those policies have a genuine rootedness in accepted standards.
I think the more that the companies hear, especially on the transparency issue, how they make decisions, how their algorithms are organized, where the training data comes from, the more they hear that, better off we are, the more chances we have of actually, it is that they are really, really tough on being willing to reveal that kind of information. But it's so important because you hear so much commentary on company behavior that is simply based on ignorance, because we don't actually have the data about what their choices are. And That is very unfortunate, because we often find that the companies will say, will be able to dismiss the criticism by saying, oh, you don't understand what's happening. You don't see the data. What you think is happening is not actually what's happened. And this is a, this is something we hear again and again. And it's a trap, because of course we don't know, because they won't give us the data. So we have to, we're operating on the basis of assumptions. But once you make, if you make the wrong call once on in that kind of context, then they are able to effectively, from a, as a rhetorical device, dismiss you outright. Say, well, you're nice, but you're wrong. So we're not gonna actually follow through with your ideas here. So figuring out how to break that paradigm so that we can actually be effective advocates or effective critics, knowledgeable critics, is something they need to hear every single time we talk to them.
The other thing I would say, and I think it's just more of a mode of organizing question, is I think we're seeing more kind of cross global South solidarity and pushing on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I would love to see a solidarity that's also cutting across from the US to many communities in the global South around making sure that we don't argue for things that are counterproductive for others who face harms elsewhere. And I'm not implying that, that people are necessarily doing that, but there is a blind spot
that
people argue for what might work well if implemented at scale with all the resources that Facebook will put to bear here, and might have very unexpected consequences elsewhere where they're not resourcing it, where they don't care, where governments will abuse it. So this is an argument for solidarity and organizing and in advocacy that's really important.
Yeah, this is especially true around regulation, because if we see, for example, the British government right now is attempting to regulate social media companies on the basis of what they're calling duty of care, which in the U.S. is about tort law, it's about harms, public health harms, and that kind of thing. A duty of care argument is problematic in the speech context, for sure, but beyond that, it also, like, to adjudicate it actually requires a competent judicial system and the ability to follow through in any kind of punitive form. If the British implement that kind of rule, you will see copycats in authoritarian contexts that will be not based on a similar set of democratically approved participatory decision-making processes that lead to good policy. They will be used to target specific groups that are not in political favor. So what might be a good policy for the UK could have extremely adverse effects elsewhere in the world. And those policies could justify those other policies. So it's really hard to use international bodies to say, China, you're doing the wrong thing, if the UK is doing exactly the same thing.
I have so many questions. I'm sure we all do. I know we also, it's getting late.
Sure.
So maybe I'll ask one closing question, and then we can continue this conversation more casually and
that sounds great.
Off the record, so to speak. But I wanted to kind of return to misinformation and disinformation. There's so much talk today about how corrosive it is for democratic institutions and dialogue, and how our institutions are withering in the face of kind of their lack of preparedness. Ivan, you've often reminded me of how this is not new necessarily. There's a long history. This exhibit, of course, attests to that long historical arc. But can you both talk more about that one? Like, as we enter the election cycle in the years ahead, will misinformation and disinformation, to allude to the title of tonight's event, like, just be further weaponized in new and unprecedented ways that, like, just further undermine optimism? To, like, what are you reading? Who are some of the critical thinkers, whether they're philosophers or activists, like, that are helping you think about how to resist, how to anticipate, how to threat model, how to imagine, like, this future that we're all facing.
This is a very big topic, so would you like to go first, or shall I give it a shot?
Sure, I may have to come back on the second part of the question, and I'll take a moment to think about that. Yeah, I think the lens I viewed this through a lot in the last 18 months is kind of where deep fakes land in that, and oftentimes. I talk to folks about sort of the history of media manipulation, and Ivan, you may disagree on this, but I a lot of times people sort of come at me and say, well, we've had this before. We've had Photoshop, and we survived. And my response to that is Photoshop didn't land in the same type of information environment as deepfakes do. And so whenever we assess a kind of technology innovation in this space, we have to look in a societal context of what we're ready to do. As well as a whole bunch of other constraints around it, like, you know, deepfakes, video and audio, cognitively we're less well prepared as voters, et cetera. But I actually think the key element is the broad scale weaponization of the ability to use images and video, and that is something that is available to people all the way down from state actors through to commercialized actors who do it in boutique shops and provide all these services to you. The flip side of that is we also have historical experience of how to try and think we can build on this. So a lot of the work we've been trying to do in the deepfake space is say, don't view this as a complete rupture. View this as an evolution as well in terms of the expertises of, you know, how we've worked out actually how to disprove and prove content online, how we have people thinking about verification and fact-checking and all of those. And those all provide these kind of sort of partial solutions in that space. But if we reduce it to just one element, like deepfakes or like bots, we're going to fail, right? It's in a much broader context of how do we think about reinventing the ways we think about trust in different ways, shoring up things we do care about for some populations, and also targeting what we do. Like, you know, sometimes people are like, well, the whole point about a deepfake isn't, you know, or a piece of fake media is that people share it because they want to create trouble or because it reinforces their emotional relationship to a movement or to a group. But there remain a significant percentage of people in most societies who do still care about factual information, do still have that basis. We should be shoring up some of that as well. So, trying to think of it in those terms of how we deal with the weaponization right now is pretty critical. And not like the temptation, it's really interesting. We spent a lot of the last 12 months, you know, talking to people about what solutions they want. And there's kind of a solutionism starting to happen in deepfakes work. And it's a solutionism led out of DC, Brussels, and Silicon Valley, where it's like, let's solve this. And in some ways, that's good, right? People are trying to get ahead of the problem before it's really widespread. On the other hand, it's exactly the problem we've had before. We're going to solve it with a technical silver bullet. We're going to come up with startup ideas. And we're going to forget about the people in Myanmar, the people in Brazil, people who live in the middle of the US. And, you know, all of those questions are going to happen again. So, deepfakes is kind of an interesting palimpsest into that kind of whole problems of how we deal with technical problems with a sort of solutionism that excludes and harms.
Yeah. I mean, I think historically, yes, all of these ideas and forms have been around for a very long time, but there is a moment in technology shifts in which more is different. And we certainly have experienced that I was talking to somebody recently who does forensic data analysis in the Philippines who has terabytes of data and tracking network analysis, like doing network analysis of the kind of the threats, the underlying technological architecture to the threats that they're experiencing and how their adversaries are setting up website upon website, you know, and linking them and how they spread around the world and how they're using different troll, you know, content farms and troll groups and they're mobilizing, you know, computer networks to overwhelm people with like a volume of expression that is just physically unmanageable from the perspective of their computers and also hateful at the same time. So at a certain point, what we understand in freedom of expression in a digital context is that the fact of expression can lead to silence for your opposition. And expression by itself, which is a cherished and primary value in the United States, has to be understood in the context of people available to listen to you. And so when we build our technological platforms, we often talk about the responsibility to listen as paired with that. But in a very simple way, it means how do we organize our information architectures so that whenever we're saying something, we know that it can be heard. And there's all sorts of questions around morality and power and authority within that framing. It is possible to build conversational spaces that are scaffolding or support for people who come from different positions, have different language skills, different education levels, different perspectives of marginality or bias or invisibility or ignorance. Most of our commercial social platforms do not do that. In fact, they privilege expression to the detriment of listening. And they do that at a pathological scale, which is why we have the kinds of social media that we have at this point. there are some solutions for them, but the misinformation piece is actually, I think it's actually an addendum to those much larger pathologies around how we construct our spaces for expression, because they are ripe for, they're built to be available for that kind of abuse. That said, we still don't know what the actual effects of that kind of expression are. Like, we focus to a large extent in our research on trying to understand what the expression is, trying to understand who's making it. A lot of times it's legal. A lot of times it's toxic, but you know, in many, many countries in the world, it's perfectly legal. There's no easy way to deal with it from a regulatory perspective. And a lot of times, even when we can see it and we try to make claims about what it might mean, our ability to make an actual, accurate claim about it, about that meaning is very, very still basic. So for example, we still don't know to what extent the Cambridge Analytica misinformation scandal actually had any effect on the 2016 elections or not. Like, we don't know. We simply don't. And that's the best we can say about it. So, I mean, there was a report produced by Rand about 5 or 6 months ago, and you may like Rand, you may not like Rand, but they put like 6 PhDs on this question for like 2 years, and they produced a study that came out in March, I think. And it begins with, we don't know. And then they spend 60 pages suggesting a bunch of solutions for what we should do, which is insane, because they don't actually know what happened, and yet they are suggesting a bunch of things that we should do to fix the problem when they can't even articulate the problem. And as it happens, I read the report, all of their suggestions are wrong or harmful.
All 60 pages?
All 60 pages of everything that they propose is a bad idea. So it's like our state of knowledge in this space is actually really quite low. We don't know exactly what's happening. We don't actually have the social science techniques to be able to study them. We have a field of expertise, which is public opinion polling and surveying, which is often broken these days because people don't answer their phones anymore, right? And then we have a space of analysis which sits in the digital world, which is analyzing big data sets. And these are separate fields of expertise. Different people do them. Different people have different educations. They don't talk to each other, and they don't you can't collate these experiences, which gives us a big, big hole in terms of the kinds of knowledge we have about it, and what we can actually say with any kind of degree of certainty. And that leads us to a place where we are often suggesting solutions without really knowing what the problem is, to Sam's point. And we will eventually, you know, we will start to regulate regardless. That's going to happen, as we've already seen it. The Europeans are already regulating. And we will see whether or not those regulations will have their own effects. And some of those effects will be positive and some will be negative. But we're operating in a realm of kind of endemic uncertainty and lack of knowledge in the space. So I think with that.
And yeah. If you want recommendations on people to read, I'm going to throw out 4 names, but you can follow them on Twitter. You don't have to read books by them. Mm-hmm. Claire Wardle at First Draft, who really follows misinformation tactics. Rene de Resta, mm-hmm. Who and Camille Francoise, who are deeply involved in the analysis of disinformation. And Maria Ressa of mm-hmm. Rappler in the Philippines, who really has been at the front of experiencing it and speaking out about it.
Yeah. So. And I'll give you a few as well. Yochai Benkler, who is a law professor at Harvard, who wrote maybe the best book I've read on misinformation in the 2016 elections, in which he concludes that most of the narratives that we think of as coming from social media actually come from mass media, and that the claims that we're making about this being a social media problem are actually not correct. So Yochai Benkler. And then I think you should follow, again, David Kaye, who's the UN Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression, who recently wrote a book on Policing
Speech the Police.
Speech Police. It's a short volume. It's yellow.
Less than 100 pages.
It's light. You can read it in an afternoon. I think if you want this is a project, and I full... acknowledgement. I'm on the board, so I should, I'm biased, but there's a project called Ranking Digital Rights, which is run by Rebecca McKinnon, one of our colleagues, that does a very admirable job of explaining how different companies create different policies for freedom of expression, and then ranks them based on human rights norms. So it's a very good place to try to get your mind around what those things are. So those three.